Listen, I think we're supposed to do something very spiritually significant today, or astrological, I don't know, something. Cleansing, intention setting, 2/2/22. I think we're supposed to do something like that. But instead, I'm gonna tell you spooky stories because it just feels right. First, I'm gonna tell you about Cade's Cove, and a lot of you are probably like, why? Let me tell you. So Cade's Cove is located about an hour or so south of Gatlinburg, Tennessee, smack dab in the middle of the Great Smoky Mountains. This is actually a United States National Park, the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, and it is the most visited national park in the States. And I can't remember the number of millions. I want to say 11, but I don't think that's right. It's because I'm looking at the number 11 to tell you that Cade's Cove is an 11-mile one-way looped road. And it sits down inside this valley and has like three churches actually within 11 miles. Cabins, barns, mountain views, wildlife, an operational grist mill, et cetera, et cetera. You can hike, bike, picnic, camp, ride horses, your little tourist heart out. It is quite possibly one of my personal most favorite spots on the planet. I have yet to visit Scotland, so I think I will probably be amending that statement later. But I love Cade's Cove. It is it's gorgeous. It's breathtaking, one might say. I've seen bear more than half of my visits there, and I used to think that that would be like the most worrisome thing to encounter, but according to local legend, myths, generational stories passed down, not the case. So we're gonna go way back and to the 19th century. Carter County residents John Oliver and Lucretia Fraser. I've also seen her name as Lurena or Lurainy. I think that's how you pronounce that. Are those nicknames for Lucretia? It seems like an entirely different name. I don't know. But I saw those in a few sources, so I wanted to mention that here. John and Lucretia were married on April 28th, 1814, and by 1818, they decided that they needed a change of pace and scenery. They were young and poor, and they dreamed of their own land and homesteading. So, along with their child and another on the way, they set off on their journey to an area that friend Joshua Job had told them about. So they all arrive, and John's like, "Yep, we'll take it." But Joshua was like, "You know what? I'm gonna head on out back to Carter County. Best of luck," because the winter of 1818 was coming, and nobody really knew how they were gonna survive. But the Olivers kept themselves alive in the valley primarily from dried pumpkin that they had received from the Cherokee tribe, who obviously had already settled in this land by 1797. That's the date that's usually referenced, but I'm sure that it was earlier than that. However, it's widely reported that the Cherokee inhabitants did not maintain a permanent residence there. Instead, they just used the valley for seasonal hunting. Now, with that being said, methinks, being a not historian but a skeptical person, that is also what I would say if I forced people out of their land. Cade's Cove originally was named by the Cherokee people, and it was, I believe I am pronouncing this correctly. I watched a video. I'm sorry if I'm not, but I believe it is the Tasayahi, which I found in most sources means place of the otter, which is like cool as hell. 'Cause imagine just like going down to the stream and seeing some otters. A lot of touristy sites say that Cade's Cove received its name in honor of Cherokee Chief Cade, who was successor to warrior chief Old Abram, who led his people at the Watauga settlement. At the bottom of Cade's Cove runs Abram's Creek, a nod obviously to Old Abram. And one more kind of like scholarly account says that Old Abram, his wife, who the white people called Katie, and their daughter and several other Cherokee women were spared during the murder of two chiefs and three warriors in 1788 by the son of a revolutionary soldier named John Kirk as revenge for the slaughter of his own family at Nine Mile Creek Massacre. Massacre, excuse me. And alas, the name Cades represents evolvement from Kate or Katie. So right from the jump, things are not good. Cade's Cove is gorgeous, like I said. You might even say heavenly. It's just an experience. You have to go there. You have to be there. You have to feel everything. But it's stolen land, much like the majority of our great country. So then, as I will get to in a few moments, it was stolen from the European settlers who stole it to begin with. So it's not good, okay? I've been throwing around the word stolen, but let's call it what the Europeans like to treated. The 1819 Treaty of Calhoun purchased land between the Little Tennessee and I believe it's Hiwassee Rivers. Probably didn't say that anywhere close to, but I couldn't find that pronunciation. So I'm sorry. So they purchased this area from the Cherokee tribe. And after this treaty, the only area that was left in the state that belonged to the Cherokees was the southeastern corner of Tennessee, which now makes up Monroe, Polk, and Bradley, and excuse me, Hamilton as well, counties. So all of those counties. Spoiler alert, the treaties that started in 1770 and ran through the 1830s gave way to the Trail of Tears. Just, you know, a little bit of genocide signed into law by our man Andrew Jackson. The Indian Removal Act was actually his number one, like, gotta check that off my list, to-do list, top priority before he took office for like a decade. That was his tunnel vision. Vice President Van Buren said, quote, "There was no measure in the whole course of Jackson's administration of which he was more exclusively the author than this." Big yikes. So you might be wondering, again, what you've stumbled on here, like thinking this was a true crime podcast, not a history lesson, but it is in fact one of our country's biggest true crime history lessons to be told, is it not? Like, it's really bad. So the point with that is we have some bad juju in Cades Cove, to say the least. In the spring of 1819, Joshua Job comes back and he's like, "Hey, Olivers, I brought you a couple of cows. Godspeed." And he gets on back to Carter County. By 1820, John Oliver has built his cabin. Now, this is the first cabin that you'll see on the loop should you ever visit, or just look up pictures. You know, they have maps, all of that. And it's one of the oldest man-made structures in the park. I believe I read somewhere that the Hearthstone Home Company, they build like custom log cabins and they're pretty popular in that area, but I'm sure that they are nationally recognized. They based their log cabin builds from John Oliver's cabin. I just thought that was kind of cool. So other settlers start arriving, and over the next 30 years, the population in the cove was roughly 685. They cleared out the forest for farming, but by doing this, they wiped out a whole bunch of native species. One example was the American chestnut. What's that, you might ask? Never heard of it, because I didn't. You probably have, because you're probably all smart people. I didn't know what that was, so I looked it up real quick. It's extinct. Technically, it's not, like, the root systems are still kicking, but it's considered functionally extinct, and no new American chestnut wood has been sold for like 50 years. So that was kind of a big bummer that they wiped all that out. But there's like a organization, some website, I can't remember what it is, and I should have captured it, sorry. But there is a group who are trying to like reestablish the American chestnut. So that's good. Anyway, families in the code had loads of children. I believe the average number was like 10 to 12 children per family. And by the turn of the century, there were more than 120 families settled in the cove. Logging companies set up shop in the area, and many residents were employed there. It was a really close community. They all assisted each other with tasks. You know, they always, it was literally like, help thy neighbor. They all worked their asses off for quite literally every single thing that they had, and they all did it together and banded together. Residents were born in the cove, lived their whole lives in the cove, fought in the Civil War, survived and succumbed to the pandemic of 1918, died on the land, buried in the Providence cemeteries where you can still visit their graves today. Like, this was everything to some people. And in fact, the last time that I went through on a Sunday, there was a service being held in the Methodist church. So I was like out there walking around looking at gravestones, and there were people inside the church singing hymns and stuff. And I'm not a very religious person. I don't know if you've picked up on that. But even I must admit, like, it was quite an experience. So that's cool that they still do that. But yeah, the people who all of these stories, this history, everything is about, they are in fact buried in these cemeteries. in the 1920s, Tennessee and North Carolina were like, hey, all of you whose families have called this home for like 100 years, we want to buy you out. And we want to incorporate the Cove into the Great Smoky Mountain National Park so that city folk can come and like breathe fresh mountain air for recreation. Some residents gladly took the money. They left the Cove. They were like, yup, out of here. Because as I said, they did everything in this cove. So life was probably pretty hard sometimes. So some residents were like, yeah, give me the money, we're gone. And they went and bought land elsewhere and what have you. Some people were given lifetime leases, which basically meant they could remain on the land until their deaths, but they had restrictions on their way of life, the way they've lived their entire lives, hunting, trapping, cutting wood, you know, when they decide, all of that stuff, no more. So they could still live on the land, but they couldn't really live their life on the land. And some people said, absolutely not. They went to court on multiple occasions, but ultimately everybody ended up losing their battle because, as I told you, it is a national park. It's part of the park. So we know what happened. The park was established officially in 1934, but the last person to remain living in the Cove was Kermit Karin. I believe that is how you say the last name. Again, tried to find some videos. I actually watched a video of his wife speaking about her time in the Cove, and it was really, really interesting. But they only say their last name one time, and I had to like keep rewinding to hear it. So I hope that I said that correctly, because they are important people. But Kermit passed away in 1999 at age 86, and I believe he left the Cove shortly before his death, but up until then he lived there the entire time and was the last person. But once he left, nobody lives there anymore. You like when you drive through and you see these structures, nobody is living there. I want to tell you like every single detail that I've been learning. I want to tell you the marital drama of Ebenezer and Matilda Shields, because number one, what a great combo, Ebenezer and Matilda. Well, it wasn't a great combo, actually, but their names, come on. I want to tell you about the drama of the churches, the moonshine wars. Like, I want to tell you about all the things that I've read in John W. Oliver's, which was John Oliver's great-grandson. So John Oliver, the original settler, his great-grandson. He was one that told the national park, like, piss off, see you in court. And he did multiple times, but like I said, sadly, we know what happened. He has like these handwritten memoirs of his life over 50 years in the Cove, and it's like in three installments, and you can find them on, I found them on the University of Tennessee's website, I believe, and they're really cool. Like you it's like a journal that they have scanned in, and it's everything's handwritten, and it's really cool. But I want to tell you about these people who took their settlement money and they put it into a bank instead of buying land right away. So most people took the money, they bought land, they got out, they bought cars, homes, they were all set. But some people were like, no, I'm gonna weigh my options here, like see what I got going on. So they put all of their money that they took in the settlement from the park system, and the bank said, we're gone. Sorry. See ya. Sign on the door. We're closed. There's so much stuff, but we're here for weird stuff. So I must move on. But just so you put that little nugget, you guys can look it up. Once the land rolled into the national parks, most of the area was razed immediately. The buildings that remain standing today that we see were selected by the Park Service. So like, it is really cool because, you know, the oldest structures are still standing, some of them, but they definitely picked what we would be seeing. And when you look at photos of the Cove when it was like actually a residence to a community, when it was a community of people, it doesn't look anything like what we see in this park. I'm going to link a video that I found on YouTube in the show description because it has so many photos of what it really did look like. And it's just like pictures of the people who lived there standing outside their homes. It's just kind of like a slideshow. It's great. Like, you should watch it, but it is just photos and captions and music. Like, there's no voiceover or anything. just so you know, but I'm going to put it down there because it was really cool to watch. So most of the people who spent their lives on this land were clearly attached, and if we are to believe in spirits and ghosties and unexplained events, it seems that a lot of them may still be pretty attached after death. In a 2001 post in the Knoxville News Sentinel online, there was a picture published taken by a woman visiting Cades Cove. Now, she had lived in the valley as a kid and would visit the area searching for old farm sites, but on one trip, she sees this cabin like really far off along the tree line, and she takes a picture, and there's a clear image of this tin roofed cabin. Like, you can see the windows, the chimney, a shadow on the ground from the cabin, like the whole nine yards. You can see everything. The woman's husband and her son visit with her, and they're like, there's no cabin here. Let me see your picture. And they look at the picture and they see the cabin. They look up at the spot, and there's no cabin. They look at the picture and you can clearly see the cabin. So they used a digital camera and then just like a regular traditional film camera and a video camera to take stills. And the cabin shows up in every single image, but it cannot be seen with the naked eye in the very area where you're standing in front of it. Now, I tried to find this article, but every link that I could scrape up was met with like 404 error, not found, every single one. I mean, it was 21 years ago, but the internet lives forever, so I'm not giving up yet. A woman named Tracy Puckett from Hillsboro, Ohio, what up, hey neighbor, submitted some images to ghoststudy.com. Her name is on that post publicly, so I assumed it's safe to share here. She was taking a picture of her stepsister in one of the Cove's churches in 2006. I think that's the stamp on the image, like the date, like July something, 2006. And in the background, on either side of the girl's head are what appear to be faces. Now, one seems like really feminine, while the other seems a bit more masculine and a little menacing, perhaps. You're supposed to be able to see handprints in the wood on the ceiling of this church. But, the reason that you can see, or you're supposed to be able to see them, is like during the time that it was being built, sap, I guess, was like still oozing out of the lumber. So the people who were building it were like sticking their hands up there on the ceiling and their handprints are there. A lot of people say that you can see them, but like most of the things that I'm reading, people are like, I can't see these handprints. I don't know. It's kind of 50-50. Like you read a lot, like, yeah, you can see them. And I haven't seen any pictures of the handprints. All of that is to say, your rational mind would assume that like these faces that you're seeing are just markings in the wood, like the handprints. So Tracy says that her mom goes back to visit the church shortly after the pictures were taken to find the markings because, duh, that's what they have to be. What she found was nothing. No markings. As long as there aren't any copyright notices that I can find, I will post the image on Instagram because it might make you go, Like the part of my brain that entertains some kind of residual energy and believes that I may have even been affected quite greatly and negatively by one a few years ago says, those look like Native Americans to me. But you can decide for yourself. The tallest tale of all from Cades Cove is about Mavis and Basil Estep. I truly have no clue if it's Basil or Basil, so we shall call him Mr. Estep. It's very fitting timing for this story because we had our first like house shaking 2 a.m. wake up thunderstorm in Ohio last night, so I'm excited to tell you about this. As legend has it, Mr. and Mrs. Estep were Cove residents and maintained their home near Whistling Branch Stream. Mavis had a healthy fear of lightning because she was born during a thunderstorm, and somehow to her, this equated that her death would be via lightning strike. You are never going to catch Mavis out in the rain. She absolutely would never be crocheting with metal needles during a storm. And one thing that you were not going to do was bring metal furniture into the Estep home. Not on her watch. Sadly, Mavis did know that she was dying, but it was not from a lightning strike. It was some unnamed severe illness. Now, near the end of her life, she told her husband, listen, I don't mind if you remarry, that's fine. But don't you dare sell my quilts, especially my favorite, my patchwork that I made out of your red flannel shirt. And if you bring a metal bed into this home, don't even think about putting one of my masterpieces on it, or your ass is grass, buddy. Okay. And Mr. Estep was like, of course, my dear, I will obey all of your wishes. Now, the favorite quilt was one that she so sweetly coined the cussing cover, because the first time that they got into any type of like marital spat, he was wearing that shirt. And he apparently said some choice words to his fair lady. So fast forward a bit, Mavis has passed on and Mr. Estep has remarried reportedly a much younger co-resident named Truly Jane Lawson. One bitterly cold evening, Mr. and Mrs. Estep, the new, are snoozing away in their metal-framed bed. And Truly's like, yikes, it's so chilly. I need an extra blankie. And Truly, stop. What are you doing? She asks her husband if she can use one of Mavis's beautiful quilts. And Mr. Estep says, why, yes, that's fine. Truly returns with the cussing cover, and she's awoken from her toasty slumber by the apparition of a woman standing at the foot of her bed, screaming and cussing, obviously. Truly tries to wake her husband up, but he sees nothing and tells Truly, like, listen, you had a nightmare. And they both just go back to sleep. A few hours later, this huge bright flash knocks Truly clear out of the bed. And when her eyes adjust, she sees her husband lying on the floor. Well done, no pink, only crispy ash remaining of the metal bed. There were no thunderstorms in Cade's Cove that night, just a single isolated lightning strike. Mavis, hats off to you. And I say that because we love a woman who does not punish other women for the stupid mistakes of men. Now, you can easily find this story with a quick internet search or inside the 1999 book by Janet Barnett and Randy Russell titled The Granny Curse and Other Ghosts and Legends from East Tennessee. But do you want to know what you can't easily find? Whether his name is Basil or Basil. Because there is zero evidence that these people ever existed. I spent an amount of time searching for two individuals that I know damn well most likely did not exist. That would be considered unhealthy. Now, I did find a Basil or Basil Estep born in Pike County, Kentucky in 1838 to John Fraser Estep and Sarah E. Norman. But here is something a little odd. His death date is listed as unknown. Both his parents' death dates are listed in these records, but their son is 1838 to question mark. At first I was like, well, maybe vital records, you know, weren't such a thing so much back then, but a lot of information on the Cove families, even from that era, is easily accessible. So there were actually Lawsons residing in Cade's Cove because Truly's maiden name was Lawson. So I don't know, man, if anybody's listening from Tennessee or has like older relatives from Tennessee and has any info to give, we the people, and by the people I mean me, want to know. So feel free to send me what you know. Now, between 1926 and 1937, officials discussed building a dam. It was 60 feet tall and 400 feet long in their great minds. Why, huh? Please tell me. Has there ever been a time that this has been a good outcome? Like, could you imagine the outrage of the ghosts if this were to happen? So their plans were to build this ginormous dam near the area that is what it's Abrams Falls is what it's known as today. It's a trailhead. And they were going to call it Lake Cades. Their cemeteries, roughly 1750 feet. I said 1750. 1750 feet below the surface of a man-made lake. Fools. So after 3 to 4 attempts at this, it was a no-go, probably luckily for them, because one thing that we have learned is you never, ever, ever cover up the final resting place of a community with water. You just don't do it. Now, in the surrounding areas of Eastern Tennessee, there's a few other pretty well-known spooky tales when you're reading about this. And if I was cool and like Tennessean, I would say Haints from the Hollers. But I'm not, so I'm just going to tell you these spooky tales. Now, one such tale is of Lucy, the mysterious love of Foster, a man who trotted horseback into town. Foster saw Lucy walking barefoot down what is now Roaring Fork Motor Trail. Okay, say that three times fast. I dare you. Send me an audio clip of it. And he was like, excuse me, miss, let me give you a lift on my horse. And she was like, hell yeah, because I'm barefoot and it's cold out. And before you know it, Foster is in love. After only one horse ride to Lucy's cabin, he's like, wow, for someone with no shoes on and this misty night, you are quite warm. And you know, I'm just in love with you. So the next day he sets out to go back to the cabin and ask her parents for her hand in marriage. Actually, first I would assume he wanted to introduce himself as a stranger and then wanted to ask if he could marry Lucy. But Lucy's parents were like, it's not weird that you're a stranger showing up here, to ask for our daughter's hand in marriage. And, this was not like the 1700s. This was like 1909. We should have known. You don't just marry a stranger that you meet off a horse. Anyway, Lucy's parents were like, no, the strangest part is we don't know who you are, but Lucy died last year in a fire. So, we can't help you. Now, some people from the area say that this story was completely made up in the 90s, but there are others who say, nope, we've been seeing her and feeling creepy since way before that. So, like, I guess we'll never know. But if you want to try to know, you got to hit the trail at dawn or dusk, preferably when it's foggy, and you have to look for the girl and with no shoes on. And she's wearing white because they're always wearing white, right? Now, while you're nearby, you can pop into the Greenbrier Restaurant, formerly the Greenbrier Lodge, down in Gatlinburg, and you can say hi to Lydia. Lydia is our second girl in white, and she was staying at the lodge back in the 1930s. I read in a couple of places that it was the 40s, so I don't really know for sure, but we'll say the 30s because I like the 30s better. And it's my podcast and I can do what I want. One day she woke up and she put on her wedding dress and she headed on out to the church to marry her man. And he was late. And then he was even later. And then like several hours came by. And sadly, this was not an Uncle Jesse situation. Like he was not out skydiving, contemplating like his decision and what he was about to do. Like, no, after all these hours, she realized this man's not coming. So she goes back to the lodge. And instead of getting hammered drunk and writing like a nasty letter to burn in the fire before sending it, as I would have suggested, instead she climbed to the second floor of the lodge, produced a rope because somehow they always have a rope handy, flung it over the rafter, and hung herself. Now, what really sucks is her man's didn't even stand her up. He was lying in the forest dead from an attack by a mountain lion. A little bit of like a Romeo and Juliet situation, except not the same at all. But some people think that he was alive and well, and he did stand her up, and Lydia took the form of the big cat to seek revenge for the humiliation of being left at the altar. So years after her death, there were claims by a lodge caretaker that he kept getting awoken, and like night after night, he was being woken up by these cries and these commands of someone saying, "Mark my grave," repeatedly. Now, after not being able to sleep for like many nights in a row, he couldn't take it anymore, and he gets up in the middle of the night to walk down the hill from the lodge and mark the spot where Lydia was buried. That had to be psychosis, because there's not a chance that I'm walking around in the dark because a ghost told me to. I'd be like, "Lydia, we can go together in the morning," but the caretaker said, "Nope, we're going to go right now. We're going to go in the middle of the night and we'll fix this." And he did. And then he says he was never awoken by cries or commands again. I have a problem. Here's my problem with Lydia. This was the 30s. Lydia didn't have any family to come claim her body. Like nobody could get a message to them in any way. They just buried her on the property of the place that reminded her of the worst day of her life. Like such a bad day that it was the reason she no longer had a life. I'm not buying it. But the restaurant patrons claim that they see Lucy still to this day, like she's all sad and piddly walking around on the second floor while they're eating their meals. And the restaurant even has like some type of pamphlet or laminated story on the table or something like that. I don't know. Now, back in some unspecified time, and I think it was the 1800s based upon later context clues, Otis Dixon was out in his barnyard just doing a little milking. It was the second day of a thick autumn fog which had clung damp and misty to the holler. And Otis looks up and he sees a young woman emerging through the haze, pale and dressed entirely in gray. And he's like, I'm a Tennessee man. Hospitality is my game. So he's like, what can I do for you, ma'am? And the woman says nothing. And instead she points to his milk pail. And Otis gives her a little bit of milk. I have to pause here and I have to say, my high school boyfriend's grandpa lived in the hills of Kentucky, okay? And he would always say, get me a bit of milk so I can take my pill. And we used to always say that because it's hilarious and adorable. And I run that through my head like quite frequently. I don't know if you guys have picked up on this, but I am medicated as I should be. So when I'm taking a pill every single day, I often think, give me a bit of milk so I can take my pill. I take it with coffee. Because, you know, anxiety juice. Anyway, I just wanted to let his sister, who sometimes listens to this, know that I think about that. So, hi, Emily. Anyway, the woman walks off without a word, but takes the milk. And Otis is like, well, that's really strange. But this is rural Tennessee, so I'm not too worried. And then it happens again, like the next 2 days. But apparently the third time is like excessive to Otis, because that's when he decided enough is enough. I'm going to follow you. And he's like hopping and skipping along to keep up with her because she's barely staying within his sight. And they hurriedly walk out of the town and into a little graveyard. And Otis is starting to regret his decision to be a freaking weirdo and follow this young girl. But I mean, like, he was giving her milk without so much as a thank you. So I might be inclined to see what the hell is going on too. I don't know. He watches her walk up to this freshly dug grave and he stands in front of it. And that's not him. It's her. She's standing there. He's not. He's like peeking at her from behind a tree, I would assume in my mind. That's what I've decided. Or maybe in a video I've seen. I don't know. She's standing in front of the grave and she's got the little milk pail. And then like all of a sudden she's just gone. She disappears. Poof. 1 second there, one gone the next. No blinks, no times. So Otis hauls ass out of there because he's like, you know what? I don't believe in these haints, but I know what my eyeballs just saw and duh. So instead of leaving it alone, let me just give you, if you get anything out of this podcast, let it be this. If you see someone disappear within the confines of a cemetery, leave it alone. But Otis didn't. He went back to town and he was like, hey, buddy, Kylie Eller, how's about a small favor? Would you mind grabbing a shovel and heading off to this grave with me? And Kylie is like, yeah, for sure. So they get to the cemetery and they start digging, which like, if you weren't haunted before, you might be now, because I find that highly offensive. And they see this grave that belonged to a woman and her infant who had died about 4 days before from the fever. I could be mistaken, but I believe that yellow fever was most commonly referred to as the fever. And so they start digging and they're getting close to the casket and they hear this baby crying and they're like, what in the world? So they pry open this pine box and inside the box, they find the body of the woman who was coming to get the milk from Otis. But in her arms lay a baby, and next to the baby was the milk pail that Otis had been letting the woman use. So Otis and Kylie, like, my bad for judging you for digging, because at first I was offended, but really you were just doing what a young mother's spirit was hoping you would. Now, should I never leave the great US of A, Tennessee is like my relocation plan. If anybody knows me in real life, like, you know, that's where I'm going. In my later years. It's got the views, it's got the spooks, it's got the body farm. I think most of you listening are true crime consumers, so as a result, like, you're just by default fans of forensic shows, books, like maybe even author Patricia Cornwell. But in case you haven't heard of it, or for the listeners outside of the US, because I didn't realize that I had so many people here internationally, like, hi. I will try to be more aware of that fact. But the Body Farm, more formally known as the Anthropology Research Facility, is located in Knoxville, Tennessee. It's on the University of Tennessee's grounds, and it was founded by Dr. William Bass, who was then the head of the anthropology department at UT. And in 1980, it was just this little small outdoor facility. And according to the website, it now, quote, provides an ideal setting to scientifically document post-mortem change. In 1981, the Bass donated skeletal collection began, and presently there are over 1,800 people whose remains have been donated to death research, birth years ranging from 1892 to 2016. Now, the website states that there are a small number of infants as well, and it's just incredible. Like, it hosts international students and provides training for law enforcement. It's like really fascinating if you're into that kind of thing. So I would recommend giving it a quick Google search. There's even some forensic anthropology merch available that I found on the website, and I was like, oh, interesting. Now, I would like to think that there are no reports of paranormal activity because the bodies are donated and most people pre-register before their deaths to be donated to the program. But a big percentage of the donations are from families of people who were not pre-registered. And even more than that, there are bodies donated from the medical examiner. So it makes me wonder. I didn't look up anything because for some reason I just felt it was like, I don't know, really out of pocket to Google like ghost stories about the body farm, but I'm probably gonna do it, actually. I don't think I'll tell you about it, but I'm gonna look it up. So if you want to do that with me secretly, I just kind of wanted to like share a little something with you guys because I was primed and ready to give you a story about Robert and Paula Sims, but the day that I was going to record, I said, you know what, let me read this 430-page book real quick. So I'm like still in the middle of reading that to finish that episode, but it will be this week's episode. So I just wanted to like give you a little something a little different, a little spooky. It wasn't that spooky, but it was a little spooky. It was our first dip into spooky. But before I go, I want to say, I think it's Kim May Casey, but it reads like Kimme. So I don't know, but I just wanted to say hi and thank you so much for your Apple review. Like, thank you so much to everyone who has left kind words before. Ohio Eric, also, thank you for giving me a, like, the equivalent of a virtual thump on the head about imposter syndrome, because forever I stay appreciating you. There's Dr. Drape. There's Lynn's Lou. I'm still searching for you because, Lynn's Lou, you won a contest, like, 6 months ago and we still can't find you. There's like several people with just, like letters and I can't make anything out of it, but like Katie M something and, AR Jones and PKS something. Like, I love all of you guys. Anyone that I might've missed, I didn't mean to, I promise, because you're all great and I love you. So I'll throw some pictures of Cades Cove and the National Park on the Instagram. Hopefully the powers that be don't block me from doing so, because I want you guys to know that this is not an exaggeration. I tried 10 times to post the images of Ray Grecar. That was my last episode, if you're like, who's that? Instagram simply refused to allow it. Every single time I got an error. It was very, very strange. And after 10 times, I was like, I want to live today, so I give up. So I stopped. So there shouldn't be any issues with the national park, but it was weird. Anyway, thank you for hanging out on this smorgasbord of tales. And don't forget to check the show description notes because I want you guys to look at the video because it's really cool. Okay, I'll be back in a couple days. Okay, bye.